May it please the court, Tom Brandt for defendants Oscar Borrego, Oscar Carrillo, and Peter Melendez. This case arises out of the unfortunate suicide of Mr. John Schubert in the Culberson County Jail on July 7th, 2019 at approximately 2:44 a.m. I would like to focus the court's attention on two concepts and two mistakes. The first concept, both of these concepts come from this court's opinion in Bonilla, as well as Cope versus Cogdell. The first concept is that suicide is inherently difficult for anyone to predict, particularly in the depressing setting of a jail. That's a quote from Bonilla. The other one is, the second concept is that generalized evidence of mental illness is not sufficient to raise a reasonable inference of a substantial and significant risk of suicide. This court in Bonilla stated as much and said that it's been reluctant to hold that generalized evidence of mental illness invariably indicates a substantial and significant risk of suicide. Those are the two general concepts that I wanted to begin with. And I want to also now move to the two mistakes. These are the two mistakes that we contend the district court made. First of all, the allegations are not sufficient. And second, no case put the defendants on notice. The allegations are not sufficient. They do not support the reasonable inference of a substantial and significant risk of suicide.
Along that line, because we are here on a motion to dismiss where qualified immunity was dismissed, so you're correct to be using the term allegations, and I have not gone to back recheck, but does the complaint, which is what we're looking at, the well-pleaded allegations in the complaint, does the complaint allege that Schubert was detained under Texas Health and Safety Code 573.001, paren little a, paren 1?
I believe the answer is no, and it's a very lengthy complaint, and I've read through it. It does not, to my mind, it does not say that. And the facts of the case are clearly demonstrate otherwise, because what happened was, as you know, there was a 911 call that came in, and it came in to jailer dispatcher Borrego. He was both the jailer and dispatcher. It came in from Mr. Schubert saying, someone is trying to kill me. Then the second call came in from an off-duty police officer saying, there's a fellow here who claims that somebody's trying to kill him. Then a third call came in from the El Capitan Hotel saying, there's a fellow here who says somebody's trying to kill him. Jailer Borrego, who was also the dispatcher, dispatches Deputy Peter Melendez. Melendez then goes, looks around for him, finally finds him at the El Capitan Hotel, talks to him, assesses him, tries to find out who he is, and he gives him a wrong date of birth. So he cannot find him on the system. So he's then thinking, okay, how do I help this fellow? And you have to understand, at this point, there is no clear indication, other than the fact that he's saying someone's trying to kill him, and that this is obviously someone who's mentally disturbed. It's not like you can automatically make that assessment. He's trying to help this fellow out, and he's trying to identify who he is. So he then takes him to the Border Patrol Station, which in that area of the state has much better resources, and it has an ability to take fingerprints and run them through a system, and they find out who he is. They find out what he did was he gave his year of birth was wrong, but he gave that to Melendez. And there was probably a reason for that, but that was because there was a warrant out for his arrest. So he then, Melendez, who was taking him just to try to help him and get him identified, then realizes, oh my gosh, I have to arrest this fellow because he's got a warrant. And
now,
the warrants
just
say command.
For our understanding, you're restricting yourself to allegations in the complaint, not your understanding.
Yes, and I would also add to the court that in our motions to dismiss, in the complaint, there is reference to the Texas Rangers report throughout. And so what we did, and portions of that report are attached to the complaint. So in our motions to dismiss, we also attached the statements that each made. So Sheriff Carrillo made a statement to the Texas Ranger, which, as you know, after every custodial death, there's a Ranger's report, an investigation. So those statements are also attached. So that's in the record.
Well, I'm not sure we can look to those statements, though, when deciding whether the complaint contains well-founded allegations that would give basis to a complaint, to a claim.
I would say, Your Honor, that in this circumstance, it is appropriate because of the way that the Texas Rangers report and findings were central to the complaint itself. So in that circumstance,
I won't argue with you about it, but I think you're going up the wrong trail on that.
Well, nevertheless, Your Honor, with respect to the events, at that point then, Deputy Melendez knows that there's this fellow in front of him, Mr. Schubert, who is saying that someone's trying to kill him, and he also knows that there's a warrant that says parole violation. So at that point, he knows he has to arrest him. He has to arrest Mr. Schubert for the parole violation because a warrant says you are commanded to arrest. Any peace officer, you're commanded to arrest. So he does.
You're still answering what it wasn't 573.
Yes.
Okay.
So this, when you
okay,
run,
so then
when you understand,
your time's going to run out. I think there was an important question, and I think I understand your answer. But isn't it plausible that the complaint alleges that by putting him into an isolation cell, that means they knew he was mentally ill and a risk of harm, and that's why they didn't ask him the suicide screening questions?
No, Your Honor. I don't think that's reasonable. I don't think that's a reasonable
inference. Okay.
No, because
that is sort of the inference they're suggesting.
Yes. Well, and going back to the allegations and then the case law, right? Because they have to do two things.
Let's deal one at a time. Let's deal with mistake number two, the case law. I tend to agree with you that it seems like we've really required actual knowledge of self-harm risk. But sticking with the insufficiency of the allegations, if it were true that they knew the person was at risk of self-harm, and that's why they put him in an isolation cell to watch, but then they didn't notify health authorities, that would be a sufficient allegation to allege deliberate indifference, right? If they knew that.
Perhaps it would be, but that's not what we have here.
Okay.
Because what we have here is the individual defendants all not cluing into the fact that suicide is in the future for this fellow. All they were saying was he was interested in self-preservation.
Yes.
He was saying, they're trying to kill me, please help me.
No one else, I'm not trying to kill myself.
I'm not trying to kill myself. Every other case has come out.
What's jumping out of this case, of course, is that they didn't do the form that Texas wants them to do.
Yes.
And could one infer that they didn't do it because they knew the answers would be negative and they'd have to refer them to health authorities? They're understaffed, they can't do it. You're looking at me quizzically, but I think that's their case.
That is a reach, Your Honor. I don't think that's a reasonable inference.
Okay.
When you're looking, particularly when you look at the case law, which says when can this inference be made of a substantial and significant risk? It has to be actual knowledge. Okay, and you can speculate as to things, but what they actually knew was he was there. He said, somebody's trying to help me, and he's there. Otherwise, he's talking.
He's delusional. He's talking about harm.
Well, but he's only delusional if those facts are not taken to be true.
Let me ask the same question another way. I'm just testing the points. It isn't necessarily what I believe, but why didn't they just use the form they're all supposed to use? Understand?
That was an unfortunate lapse in the protocol. Yes. They should have done that. But they didn't. And I think it had to do with just what the sheriff did himself was came late at night, came to the jail to investigate and talk to the fellow and talk to Mr. Schubert, satisfied himself that he was okay, wrongly, obviously, but did talk to him, thought he
was. I'll just say again, sheriff comes late at night, he's thinking, I can't bother anyone else, I don't want to get him to health authorities, But I know he's mentally ill, and he might say he's a risk of self-harm if I ask him the questions. So I'm just not going to ask him the questions, but we'll cover ourselves and watch him by putting him in the isolation cell.
That's a conspiracy theory that's not supported by any factual pleadings at all or the investigation that's been made.
Yeah.
There's no suggestion at all that this was a conspiracy of three people to allow this man to kill
himself. No, it's covering up understaff, and they can't ask the questions everyone is supposed to ask in jail, especially of mentally ill people.
Right. And this is a small jail, and we're a small staff.
And two of the people previously, isn't it correct, it's in the record, Carrillo and Melendez, have been involved with a woman who then commits suicide.
That is correct. But Melendez doesn't know anything other than, I found out who this guy is, and I know he has an arrest warrant. I've got to take him in. Then I get called away. Then I come back. He doesn't know what has happened while he was away.
Right.
Sheriff Carrillo interviews the fellow personally, and you can speculate that he had some nefarious motive in doing so, but there's nothing in the record.
Nothing nefarious. He's understaffed. It's only him. He wants to put him in the isolation cell. He doesn't want to deal with health authorities.
Well, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that would suggest that as a reasonable inference.
Okay.
Because what you've got here is a fellow who's trying to preserve his life and has made no outcry. In the cases that are cited against us these are the two cases.
Right.
Jacobs.
Crystal clear, they knew.
They knew, absolutely. There was one who said, I stuck a gun in my mouth and tried to kill myself, and the only thing that didn't prevent that was the gun didn't work.
So the second prong mistake, the district court here, there's no law that knows.
There's no law. And that, to me, is the answer to this case. Why the district court made the mistake it did was because in Bonilla and in Cogdill, this court has been very clear in following the directives of the Supreme Court and saying you have to have a case on point where it's been held to be a violation, and that's the first step. And then second, you have to have the explanation from the plaintiff appellees in this case that say, how did these two cases control? Well, we know, of course, that Converse couldn't control because it came after the fact. So it only would be Jacob versus Feliciano that would qualify as a possible prior decision which would put them on notice. And we know from Jacob versus Feliciano that they absolutely knew that this person was suicidal, and they put them on a suicide watch because the person said, yes.
Let me ask you, counsel, are you saying that looking at clearly established law, that the only clearly established law that we need to be or can apply is one that says if you are absolutely sure, then there can be liability? Because what the district judge here did, looking at Jalen Borrego, she summarizes, the district judge summarizes what she thought was enough to put him on notice, and witnessed the conversation between the sheriff and Schubert, where Schubert said, information that, and she doesn't say what it is, would further support an inference that Schubert was at risk of suicide. Also says Schubert told Carrillo in the presence of Borrego that he had a history of drug problems, recently was in rehab, hitchhiked from El Paso. He was obviously mentally ill. Reasonable inference from that she makes is that he should have been put on suicide watch. So that collection of facts may be far afield from absolute certainty. But are you saying that absent a case that says that reasonable people would understand this person was at risk of suicide, then there can be no liability until such a case is handed down? Well, isn't that really what the law is, though?
Qualified immunity protects...
I know, but what do you say the constitutional standard is for the
actual knowledge is the
of
first
what?
Of a substantial and significant risk of suicide.
So what the district judge was saying, I find these collections of facts create that inference.
Yes, but no prior case had decided that those facts were sufficient. And because of that, qualified immunity attaches for those individuals. Because they were not...
Do you mean, does that mean unless you have unless they have information from this detainee that he had once put a gun in his face inside his throat and tried to shoot and it didn't work, that those are the only facts that would make this kind of certainty?
I'm not saying those are the only facts, but there's
So there's going to be a variety of facts.
There are a variety
so
of facts.
The issue is, do those facts constitute the kind of do they qualify to meet the standard?
The facts alleged do not. They do not. On the sufficiency of the allegations, number one, they do not. But even accepting that for a moment, I see my time is up, but even accepting that for a moment, under the qualified immunity rubric that the Supreme Court has laid down and this court has adopted, there has been no case of similar circumstances where a jailer has been held liable. So there was no fair notice to these individuals that they would be held liable if they, in these circumstances, didn't immediately engage the protocol.
Well, these facts may not be enough, but I'm almost getting the impression from your answer that the only facts that would meet the standard is evidence that this person tried to kill himself in some way before.
That's the only. Those are the only facts that have been.
So absent that in this record, that there's no clearly established law. Absent some evidence that he had once tried to kill himself before,
or was suicidal at the point. If he was saying, "I want to kill myself," instead of saying, "I want to preserve my life," yeah. If he was saying, "I want to kill myself," then they would have actual knowledge of a suicidal ideation, and they would have to respond to that. But those are not the facts.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Bruce Thomas, on behalf of the appellee plaintiffs, the estate and heirs of John Schubert. I would like to primarily address two issues today. That I think are directly responsive to the defendant's thrust of the defendant's argument that they never received final confirmation that John Schubert.
Well, before you start on that, would you answer the question asked him? Because I don't know
believe
it's cited in your complaint that do you in your complaint state that Schubert was detained under Texas Health and Safety Code 573.001 subpart A1.
We don't phrase it exactly like that.
Don't you instead say they had to have known?
Yeah, what we say is...
They had to have known, not that they did detain him under that.
No. With respect to Defendant Melendez, we say Defendant Melendez was fully aware of Chapter 573. This is at paragraph 39. Defendant Melendez was fully aware of Chapter 573 and his obligation to transport John to an appropriate mental health facility. And he should have done so.
Well, how can that be a well-founded allegation? How do you know what she was aware of? This is your complaint. You hadn't taken any discovery to know what she knew.
Because of the well-pleaded facts in the complaint of what was happening at that time.
No, but how can you say someone had to have known when this is the complaint? This isn't a recitation of deposition testimony.
Well, we're alleging what facts were available to him, what his training was, and therefore what he should have known and what he reasonably would have known.
We look on the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim in a complaint, the well-founded allegations and the reasonable inferences to be drawn from them. I don't know that we have to be mind readers.
No.
Nor can you. Making your complaint say what they knew or should have known. What they knew, now if you'd have said should have known, but you say what he knew.
Well, I think we can say what he reasonably would have known under these facts.
You don't say what he reasonably knew, you said what he was aware of.
Yes, that's what we allege based on these facts. With respect to Defendant Carrillo, he specifically makes reference to it. So that is another fact on which we are basing our allegations that the defendants were operating initially under Chapter 573.
How does the complaint say Carrillo was acting pursuant to it?
Because it says that he referenced that he was coming up there to interview him prospectively for an emergency order to ship him to El Paso for evaluation. An emergency order is exactly what Chapter 573 is, and that's what we allege in our complaint, that he must have been referring to Chapter 573 given his comments about the emergency order. and that's why the defendants initially, we allege, were operating under Chapter 573 and should have been. So that's our allegation. In none of the defendants, the first thing I'd like to point out, that in none of the defendants' briefing or argument today do they address what I think is a very important part of the district court's opinion at page 12 and 13, where the district court quotes from the Farmer versus Prentice opinion, where the Supreme Court states, an official cannot escape liability if he refuses to verify underlying facts that he strongly suspects to be true or declines to confirm inferences of risk. An official may be liable for failing to protect a detainee when an officer is aware of a high likelihood of harm to the detainee, but resists opportunities to obtain final confirmation. That's what we allege the defendants were doing here. At the very least, it's a fair inference that defendants highly suspected John was a danger to himself. He was engaging very alarming behavior, running around town late at night, shirtless, running up to people, running up to strangers, knocking on doors, claiming someone was trying to kill him. So much so that they sent Deputy Melendez out there to find him. Before Deputy Melendez is aware of the outstanding warrant, he detains him. I don't think the facts allege any other purpose, any other basis for detaining him at that point than 573. I think the district court was right.
How is this case distinguishable from Bonilla, really? Okay. And particularly, he did see, of course, the man seemed very delusional, but he isn't saying self-harm. He's saying others will harm him. And so if opposing counsel correctly described Bonilla, those generalized awareness of severe mental disorders don't themselves put jailers on notice the person's self-harm risk.
Well, here, I think Bonilla provides a good counterpoint, actually, to what we have here. We don't have generalized allegations. We have very specific allegations of this man being under a grips of paranoid delusion. And the district court, I think, correctly said that obviously when somebody's under grips of paranoid delusion, that they could be a harm, they are likely to harm themselves or harm other people.
So it's a counterpoint, but what case specifically says mental illness where there's no statement, averment, evidence of self-harm, no self-inflicted wounds, puts jailers on notice that the person has to be put on suicide watch? What case do you have as opposed to a negative?
We don't have a case that says, that has those facts. But I think I have two responses to that.
Okay.
Number one, the analysis here is the first prong is an evidentiary issue. What evidence, what allegations do we have, and ultimately evidence do we have for the factual determination that the defendants were subjectively aware of a risk of harm? And that's determined by circumstantial evidence or any evidence that we have. If that favorable fact is made for us, that they were subjectively aware, that's when the clearly established law prong comes in, on the second part of the test. It looks to me
like understaffing and maybe negligence. You should just ask every question you could of someone who's saying he's going to be killed by somebody else. But it's just hard to see on this complaint where there was subjective awareness of self-harm.
Well, there was subjective awareness of self-harm on two bases.
Okay.
First of all, under the Farmer case, they don't have to obtain final confirmation of it as long as they strongly suspect it. And here, they went out and detained him and were contemplating a 573 emergency order and sending him to El Paso. So at least we're entitled to a fair inference here that the defendants had highly suspected that John could be a danger to himself. And then, as you pointed out in your earlier question, this is exactly what we're alleging here, that the defendants betrayed their subjective knowledge when they put him in the cell. They didn't just, if they really believed that he wasn't a danger to himself, they would have treated him the same as any other detainee. They would have just housed him with the other detainees, but they didn't do that.
But he thinks other people are going to kill him. makes sense to not put him in with other people.
Well, that's one inference that you could draw, but I think the favorable inference that should be drawn for us is that they put him in that cell, one, because they didn't trust his answers, they didn't believe him, and they had come to the conclusion that he could very well injure himself. And secondly, what the jailer says when he puts him in his cell. The jailer tells us that they put him in cell number 4 so that they could keep an eye on him better. The exact words were easier to keep an eye on the subject. So why did they need to keep an eye on?
How's that pled in your complaint?
How's that pled in our complaint?
Right. Why they put him in the cell? What's your basis for saying that?
Our basis for saying that is it's part of the record on the motion to dismiss because they put in the.
The standard here is we look only to well-founded allegations and draw reasonable inferences from them. This is not a summary judgment. This is a motion to dismiss.
I fully appreciate that. But
you apparently don't because you keep talking about matters outside the four corners of your complaint.
But the court can consider that and did
How
consider
can
that.
We consider that?
Because that's as they cited in their motion to dismiss.
But we don't look to what they say in their motion to dismiss. We look only to your complaint and any attachments to it.
And their attachments.
No, sir. We don't look to their attachments.
Yeah, well, respectfully, Your Honor, the law in this circuit is that if we rely upon statements that are critical to our complaint and we have summarized them as we do and they come forward and attach them and they want the court to consider them and we didn't object to the court considering them.
Cite me that case. What's that case?
It would take me a couple of minutes
to
find it, but I will be happy to send the court a 28J letter citing that authority. It's the authority the defendants rely upon in their motion for attaching those letters and asking the court to use them. And those letters say that they put him in that cell in order to make it easier to keep an eye on the subject. Why would they need to keep an eye on that subject more than any other defendant, or I mean more than any other detainee, unless they had come to the conclusion that he's at risk of harm? Because he's in a cell by himself, he couldn't be harming anybody else. The only reason that they need to keep an eye on him is because that they have come to this objective conclusion that he's at risk of doing harm to himself and that he needs to be watched. But then they don't do that. They all just leave and leave the detainee there in a cell with an obvious ligature that he uses to hang himself. It's the same sort of evidence that the court cited in Converse versus City of Pima to come to the conclusion that one of the jailers who claimed not to be aware of the detainee's suicidal tendencies, in fact, betrayed his knowledge by what he did. He put the detainee in a cell with cameras, particularly in a cell with cameras so that he could be watched, and then also took away his shoes. Yet he claimed that he didn't know the detainee was suicidal and therefore gave him a blanket that the detainee used to hang himself.
Let me ask you this. I think you are emphasizing your best allegation, and I want to see what else it may be. What you need is sufficient, an allegation, it seems to me, let me posit this anyway. Sufficient allegations create an inference that the jailers, one of these defendants or more of them, knew, subjectively aware that this fellow was a suicide risk. There may be more to it than that, but let's just leave it at that. The fact they put him in a single cell to keep a better eye on him is at least something. What else do you have that's in that mode? Not what they should have, not what Schubert had said that you think should have created this inference, or created this knowledge. What else is in your complaint that actually is an inference that they knew, not should have, but they actually knew. And I do think the single sale is headed that direction. What else is there?
Well, the fact that they knew he was delusional, that he was under the grips of a paranoid delusion.
Okay, but I still think the problem for that that's been discussed in argument so far, question so far, is that mental illness is not the same thing as having suicidal tendencies.
No, but the Bonilla case points out the difference between the general and the specific indications of mental illness here. Bonilla, it was just in the individual's background. And they did all the things in Bonilla that these defendants failed to do here. They found out about the mental illness by doing screening, by doing mental health screening. And then they amped it up by referring the information they had out to mental health authorities and a magistrate who did not had an opportunity to weigh in, and they did not recommend a mental health screening. The court ended up saying in Bonilla that the circumstances of the arrest, booking, and detention did not raise questions concerning the detainee's mental stability or capacity for harm. Here it was just the opposite. John Schubert's mental stability was why John came to the attention of the Sheriff's Department to begin with. It was because they sent him out. It was because of his mental instability that they sent a deputy out to detain him, and because they continued to detain him at the cell and were considering a detention order. They changed the narrative. They wanted to change the narrative after the fact by discounting what they saw, by discounting the paranoid delusions that John was under. John was clearly acting erratically and in an alarming manner. Erratic and alarming is the phraseology the court uses in Bonilla where the evidence is lacking. And that's exactly what we have here from beginning to end. John was under distress. John was claiming that somebody was trying to kill him. That was his last words when they put him in the cell. He continued to say, somebody's trying to kill me. So when a person is under that sort of delusion, they may do harm to himself. It's the district court, I think, correctly said it was obvious that a person under that sort of delusion would commit harm to himself. The defendants are essentially saying, well, John, after the fact, they're saying John appeared just fine to us, except that he was under a paranoid delusion that people were trying to kill him. But a person that is under a paranoid delusion isn't otherwise fine. That person is engaging in self-destructive behavior, erratic behavior, alarming behavior. It is apparent that they are at risk of doing harm to themselves while they're under that condition. So, Your Honor, that's my answer, that they are aware of that condition, and then there's some evidence, or our allegation is, that if they put him in a cell to keep watch on him, and I will give you the case where we can use the letters, that, and we could obviously, I think we obviously will be able to amend to put that in, if necessary, that is additional evidence of their subjective knowledge.
All right, counsel. Thank you. You don't have much time.
Yeah, I'll be quick.
Do your best.
Good morning. I don't know what time it is, but it's probably still morning. Good morning. And I'm Brandon Duke on behalf of the various amici who are disability rights advocates and mental health advocacy organizations. I want to hone in specifically on 573 and the screening form requirements. And just like Judge Barksdale mentioned, that this was a motion to dismiss stage, so the pleadings and the standard, you know, would be what was pled and whether or not, you know, you should read them in the facts most favorably to the plaintiff. I think the district court was correct at record site 638 when she said that the facts viewed most favorably in light of the plaintiff is that Deputy Melendez detained Mr. Schubert pursuant to 573. I think the facts as alleged support that, both the fact that he was, you know, detained before he was identified. He was detained and then taken to a Border Patrol facility, identified, and that's when the warrants were identified. So that period of time when he was originally detained had to have a basis, and we believe that there's a reasonable inference that 573 was that basis. And so with that, along with the screening, we wanted to in particular emphasize that the state of Texas has adopted both 573 and Section 273 of the Texas Administrative Code specifically to address these concerns of death by suicide in jails, because it is a large, long-standing, well-known, pervasive feature of jails. And so, because of that, far too often, those requirements that the state of Texas adopted as policy have been ignored. And separately, we also think that it goes to, I think what Judge Higginson was potentially referencing, it goes to the knowledge factor, both from with respect to 573, because in order to detain Mr. Schubert, the deputy needed to have acquired knowledge that there was a substantial risk of harm to Mr. Schubert or to others. And
wasn't he detained because of an outstanding warrant?
So no, that's the exact, according to the facts as alleged, I think it's paragraph 22, I don't have the record site, he was taken to a Border Patrol facility, and that's when his warrant was identified. So there was a period of time when he was taken from the El Capitan Hotel to the Border facility by the officer, and he was taken pursuant to 573. So he acquired that knowledge based off of the statute alone. And then separately, we want to emphasize that the screening requirements don't just like make it reckless to not do it. It is state of Texas policy that officers shall, like jailers shall, as soon as someone arrives to jail, proceed to forward with the screening. And if the screening can't be completed or otherwise or other indications occur, jailers are required to provide protection from suicide, including putting them on suicide watch, because that's the requirement. It doesn't, we think that goes to whether or not there's a reasonable inference of knowledge, because the state of Texas says you must do that. So you it's effectively the state imputing knowledge on the jailer up until the point that they complete the form and disclaim that knowledge. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Kelsey.
You referred to paragraph 22 of the complaint as the basis for this theory about 573, and it has nothing in that paragraph about 573 whatsoever. It says Sheriff Carrillo told Ranger Torres that he checked on Deputy Melendez and was told that Deputy Melendez had taken John to a Border Patrol station for identification. Sheriff Carrillo said that at approximately 12:59 on July 7, 2019, Sheriff Carrillo learned that John was in the booking room at the Culberson County Jail. He said he decided to go to the jail and check on John and jail personnel. That's paragraph 22. There's nothing in there about 573 at all. The suggestion that he was detained for 573 is wrong, both. It's not in complaint, and it's wrong factually from what we know from the complaint itself. When there was a disturbance that John Schubert called 911 saying somebody's trying to kill me, and a deputy was dispatched to that location. He then says, what's your name? What's your date of birth? He gives them wrong date of birth. He then knows he has to identify this fellow, so at least he's got probable cause to believe that he has been lied to, so he's failed to ID to a police officer. That would be the basis for the detention. Before that, it was a community caretaking function that he was doing, trying to investigate a possible crime of someone trying to kill John Schubert, or the disturbance that John Schubert was making at the El Capitan Hotel. There's nothing about 573 in all of this. What we do know now from Mr. Thomas's presentation that they have admitted, we do not have a case that has these facts.
But just to finish up in the detention, so yes. You're not saying he voluntarily went to the Border Patrol. They had to have some basis. When they get to Border Patrol, they know about the probation. But between the encounter and the Border Patrol, he is detained, and you're suggesting it was because of a false ID?
Because Melendez is called to the scene of a disturbance and a possible crime. The disturbance from the El Capitan Motel is saying, hey, somebody's crazy.
Yes.
Okay, so he has to say, is there somebody actually trying to kill you? Who is it? And who are you? And why did you cause this disturbance? And wait a minute, you've told me a lie. You've identified yourself wrongly. I can't find out who you are. Okay, come with me. So that's his justification. Now, if I could, in my remaining time, address, there are no cases that have given clear warning, fair notice to these jailers. That is absolutely established now. The only case that was cited in response to the questions was Farmer versus Brennan. But as we all know, Farmer versus Brennan was a completely different set of facts. A transvestite.
But what about Bonilla? That itself was a difficult case, but there they had done the screening. So the point just made now is, if you don't do the screening that is mandatory, then you presumptively have to assume suicide watch. What's wrong with that argument?
That argument is wrong because there is not a constitutional deprivation in the failure to do the suicide screening itself. That's Taylor versus Barks, established that the protocols for suicide screening that may be applied under state law are not constitutionalized. So it is sufficient under the Constitution for Sheriff Crea to have assessed Mr. Schubert himself and to satisfy himself it was a failure of his subordinates not to fill out a form, but it was not a constitutional deprivation to have failed to fill out
the form. Remind me, does the form say if the detainee refuses to answer the suicide questions, you must notify health authorities? You've got to.
No, it doesn't say must. We go into that in the brief in detail. I don't have enough time, but we do analyze.
Okay, go into the argument.
Okay. And that my point on Farmer versus Brennan, the only case that you've been referred to, is that is factually totally different, because it was a transvestite male who was released to the general population and then was raped. And then the idea was, well, come on. The Supreme Court is like, what? You know, you cannot just turn a blind eye. You can't just. But even in that case, they said that's where they decided that had to be subjective knowledge that this was likely to occur. It's a different situation.
Just to follow up on this point of your saying there's no constitutional right to screening. You know, the prong one of qualified immunity is a constitutional or statutory right. And you're saying there's no statutory right to screening. Is that what you're saying?
There is no federal statutory right to screening.
Right.
Taylor versus Barks has decided that. And I'm sorry, but I'm out of time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to all of you. That concludes our arguments for this morning. There are more tomorrow, though. We are in recess.